All right, good morning, golfers. Welcome to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. Pleased to be joined in studio, co-owner of Pete's Golf Shop, Woody Lashin. Woody, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we got a special guest this week, so I'm very excited to talk to Keith Foster, who did the wonderful renovation of the Greenbrier. Well, I should say the Old White, where they're playing the Greenbrier, where the PGA Tour is now. Lots of crazy stuff in the news with the USGA and, just a normal week of golf.
I love talking golf architecture, so yeah. This is going to be fun.
It should be a good show. All right, we're going to be, let's take a short break so we can get right to it with Keith Foster. You're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsia.
The Long Island Golf Association is a nonprofit organization of 81 private and public clubs. The LIGA conducts 15 championships annually and works closely with the Long Island Caddy Scholarship Fund. The scholarships are granted to young men and women who are employed at member clubs. For more information on how you can participate in a championship, or if you'd like to donate your time as a volunteer, please call the LIGA at 516-746-1015. That's 516-746-1015. 1015, or visit us at www.longislandgolf.org.
Pete's Golf. Since 1979, Pete's Golf has been practicing the art of club fitting and has been selected as a top 100 club fitter by Golf Digest magazine. At Pete's Golf, we use the best technology available to create an exceptional fitting experience for every customer that walks into our store. Visit petesgolf.com or call 516-248-6891. That's 516-248-6891 and get your next set of clubs fit for you.
All right, welcome back to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. In studio, Woody Lashin, and on the line is golf course architect Keith Foster. Keith, how are you doing this morning?
Anthony, I'm doing awesome. And you?
Yeah, doing fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. A lot to get to. Let's start with the Greenbrier, and you were responsible for restoring Old White. Let me take us through sort of your mindset, I guess, when a golf course gets completely wiped out, as they did through the devastating flooding that occurred a year ago, and then you're tasked to bring it back to life, what's kind of the first thing that goes through your mind when that happens?
Well, you know, what was crazy about that is 8 months before the flood, the club, the Greenbrier, calls me up, and they just said, "Hey, Keith, look, you know, we've heard a lot about you. Can you come out and take a look at the course?" And I did. I met with Lee Trevino and all the guys at Greenbrier, and Lee Trevino is awesome, man. I mean, he is so charming and so wonderful. And so anyway, I met with those guys, and I said, you know, what you have right now, I know you're thinking it's a Seth Rayner, CB McDonald course, but the work's just not there. And you know, we just kind of talked through it, and they said, you know, we're not able to make a move on anything, but thanks so much for coming out. So 8 months later, I'm just having, breakfast with my wife, and on a Saturday morning or something, and they said, you know about the flood? I'm going, what flood? And I mean, I live 4 hours away. I didn't know anything about it. So they said, Keith, how fast can you come in? So I came in like 2 days after the flood. You drive through White Sulphur Springs, and Anthony, it was almost like third world. You drive through it and you go, this is surreal. And then you get to the club, and everyone was so discouraged because, heck, there were dogs trying to find bodies on the golf course.
Ugh.
And so, it's real. And so, but look, at the end of the day, my job is to encourage people to do great work and to do the best work I can do. So you just go into that mode and say, they said, Keith, what do you think? And I said, we can absolutely do it. Let's go ahead. And we just jumped on it, and I was just so thankful to be given the privilege to work there. I mean, it's a wonderful resort, wonderful people, and it was a great experience to be part of it.
Keith, I'm curious to talk about the clubs in our area that you've done. So I got Sands Point, Century, and Fresh Meadow. Am I missing anything?
You know, really not. The only thing that I'm working on. So, of course, Century is a Colton Allison course, which I love, and Fresh Meadow is the same. It's an Allison golf course, which is 1924. And Sands Point is a Tillinghast, 1922. And all three of those golf courses are just wonderful. And I'm actually getting ready this fall to work at Apawamis, which is really interesting because, it's a Dunn golf course who did Shinnecock. And there's just a lot of history there, and it's just a quirky, wonderful, charming place. So, that's where my focus is. So this year, I'll be focusing on this fall, Century and Apawamis there, and finishing up the program at Century, which is also an awesome club.
So I've been lucky enough to have the pleasure to play of all three of those courses before and after you did your work, and I absolutely love what you've done. I'm curious about what your opinion is, restore versus renovate, and why you would did certain things with those golf courses.
You know, and Woody, I mean, that's a really good, you know, point to kind of talk on. You know, a lot of people will say, oh, I restore a golf course, or I renovate a golf course, or I reconstruct. I try not to use any of those words, because, you know, if I restore, I'm putting it exactly back. Nobody wants to play the game exactly in 1922 or 24, and you can't put the features in because the game's changed so much then.
Yes.
But what you can do, and, you know, I strive to make the golf course the best that it can be right now in the spirit of the original architect and his intent. And I don't really look at myself, honestly, as a golf course architect. I look at myself as, I pretend like if I'm working on an Allison golf course, okay, I'm working for Allison, and my job is to execute his features better than he could even execute them. Or the same thing with Tillinghast. And I take it as a challenge because it puts me in my place, which is, it's not about me. It's about the club that I work for and the pedigree that I'm working at. And as long as I frame it like that, I am restoring, you know, but some things. I'm renovating some things, but I'm trying to make it great.
You're trying to do it more, if you will, maybe for the modern game, the modern ball, how the game is played today. Or, I mean, like, you know, for, if you will, you know, a bunker that was, you know, 240 to carry 100 years ago could be, you know, close to impossible for most golfers today. You know, most golfers hitting it over that. So you've got to adjust for that. Is that a good take?
Yeah, that's a great take. And, you know, there are some architects that will say, look, if Ross put it here, Tillinghast put it here, that's good enough for me. But I don't think it is, because I don't think it transfers to where the game is now. But on the other hand, you can't be flippant about it, and you can't just say, I'm going to do this, because I know better than. You know, sure, our eye is sharper now than it was, you know, back in the day, probably because we just spent so much time, you know, on site. But I just try to frame it like that, but you're spot on.
Let's talk about bunkers for a second. Do you have a preference, grass face, sand face, or are you just doing what the original architect had in mind?
You know, I try to do what the spirit in which the original architect had intended, and that's why I like working on different architects' projects. So, for instance, if I did all Ross renovations and or restorations, or whatever you want to call it, then all of my stuff would tend to look the same. Or if I had my own look that I was trying to impose, bunker-wise or whatever else, all of my work would look the same. And so by working with different programs and different original architects, it forces me to, you know, improve my game so that I can do work that it doesn't really look like, you know, I, Keith, you know, was there, but rather the original architect, you know, shine. So, yeah, I mean, the easiest bunker to construct and the easiest bunker to maintain, some would say, a flat-bottom bunker, grass face, which is old school, which makes sense because in 1900, 1910, 1920, they just didn't have the equipment that we have to maintain. But now with the liner products that you can put in for a sand face that holds the sand up in storms, that's a very viable bunker. But that bunker costs more to construct, to create, because it takes twice as much sand. It takes a lot of underpinning in terms of drainage. So when you look at a sand-faced bunker, it's really throwing sand up. It's twice the cost of a grass-faced bunker. And that's not why people do grass-faced bunkers, because it's cheaper. It's just architecturally probably correct.
You know, you said something there that I think that every greens chairman at every private club should listen to. You're not trying to put your own mark on a golf course. You're trying to just make it as best as it possibly can. And you see it all the time where, you know, a greens chairman says, I want to put a tree here and a bunker there, and, you know, to try to make their own mark of why I did this or I did that. And here is the golf course architect coming along going, no, I don't want to put my name on this. I want to make the golf course the best it can be from its original design. And that to me is huge, because you're trying to make the golf course the best it can be and not put your own, you know, mark on it.
Well, and, you know, you're hitting on something that is, you know, critical. You know, there are, when I was a younger guy, or, you know, when you're cutting your teeth, when all of us are cutting our teeth at whatever we do, we make a mistake sometimes of doing things too heavily and not using restraint and trying to leave a mark. And, you know, the mark that we leave, if it's softly placed and wonderfully placed, it, you know, it really rings truer. And so that's something that committee chairs, presidents, we all want the best club or the best course that we can be part of. But oftentimes, you know, when a mark is left by either an architect, a committee chair, or a president, you know, it's not long standing. You know, it devalues, I think, the course. So I'm very mindful that, and I'm so critical of my work because I don't want to leave a mark. And you know, all the clubs that I work at, they say, well, Keith, you know, we want to, you know, put your name on a card or whatever else and just, you know, recognize what you've done. I said, no, please don't. Please don't. I so don't want, you know, my name on it. I just want to make sure that, you know, the course shines. And I just think that's critical to do, or at least I've learned that.
Of all the golden age architects that you've tried to either restore or carry on the spirit of, if you will, if you were only left with one where you would work on for the rest of your career, whose would you pick?
You know, that is so difficult. I mean, it really is, because all of these guys have certain talents and gifts and abilities. So I'll go two. I'll give you the one.
Give me one and one A. How about that?
Okay, so the one probably would just be Tillinghast, because, you know, he has so many stories about him and about the terror of Tilly, the terror, you know, the drinking, the art, you know, the antiques. He had such a varied career and also varied designs, and his bunker style was different, and he was just a more fluid golf architect. So I tend to, you know, I would probably say Tilly, if I had to work on golf courses, you know, of his, I'd love to do that. On the other hand, you know, 1A would be Allison. So Colt and Allison. Harry Colt was this English architect, you know, back in the day over there, did incredible work. I mean, I think he's probably the best golf architect there was. But he had a partner, Allison, and Allison came over here. I'd love to make it a career just to put Allison courses back to his, you know, his epic designs. So many of the Allison golf courses in the States that we have now are, you know, shells of what he created, because they've just been watered down or beat down, or worse yet, what you were saying about, you know, architects leaving their mark.
Right.
You know, so many architects have just, you know, overdid the work or took it out. And, sure, you know, I'd love to make a career, you know, correcting all of that.
We got to take a short break. We'll be back with more with Keith Foster, golf course architect. You're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsia.
Hi, I'm Dr. Frank Rossi of Cornell University. As the stewards of New York's golf courses, superintendents are dedicated to protecting our natural resources. In heavily developed areas like Long Island, golf courses offer large expanses of open space that provide environmental benefits, such as allowing water to infiltrate into the ground naturally and providing habitat for native species such as bees and butterflies. To help manage golf courses in harmony with the environment, the state's golf industry has established a comprehensive best management practices program to educate and serve as a resource for superintendents. For more information, see our website at nysgolfbmp.cals.cornell.edu.
Play like a pro with a custom set of PXG clubs in your bag. Designed to deliver unrivaled performance and fitted to optimize your game, PXG clubs will help you unlock your true potential. We guarantee you've never played like this before. Get fitted for PXG clubs at Pete's Golf Shop today.
All right, welcome back to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. Pleased to have Woody Lashin in studio and on the line golf course architect Keith Foster. Keith, we're talking about a little bit ago, we were talking about, you know, the sort of maturing process or the maturation process of a golf course architect. Where do you feel like you have, you had noted that a lot of times people come out and when they first start and they want to be bold and leave their marks and sort of like any other idealistic young person in any career, but where do you feel like you have transformed the most in terms of what you do for a living?
Well, Anthony, I mean, you know, the way you're phrasing it and everything else is really a critical tone for a golf architect, or really any person that's trying to mature in their careers. You know, I finally think I'm getting there. You know, what was interesting is about 12 years ago, you know, I started working on really great, you know, classic American golf courses, and my mentor took me around, and we played two powerhouse golf courses, you know, four courses in Chicago, Chicagoland area, right? We played two great, classic, old-school places, and then we played two powerhouse golf courses. And if I mentioned the names, everyone would know them.
Right.
And then at the end of the day, you know, at the end of these 2 days, we played 36 and 36. I said, Keith, what do you think? And we talked about it. He said, look at the difference between work that endures and work that is just superficial. And he said, you know, and he said, what do you think? And I said, I want to strive towards work that is, you know, enduring.
Mm-hmm.
And how do I do it? And I just kind of reframed my whole career based on that and just saying, look, I just want to do work that's so soft that endures. And, you know, we have a great game. I mean, it is an awesome game. And, you know, if I can be part of something that, you know, ensures that golf courses, you know, just feel like they've always been there and that are natural and not forced. And so, you know, I think my eye now is the best it's ever been, and I'm focused on that. And I just know now what's at risk, you know, when I'm touching a golf course. Because if a golf architect messes up or overdoes something, I mean, you know, it has a tremendous impact, a tremendous negative impact on the club, on the membership, on the perceived nature of the club. So, you know, I'm very aware of the weight on all of these. And so, you know, I think I'm finally, like I said, I think I'm finally getting there.
Keith, you know, one of the things that I think that I see is missing from our game, especially in our older golf courses, is enough sets of tee boxes. You know, I was saying, Anthony, this morning that, you know, him and I go play, we've got, you know, well, theoretically, I have three choices. I can play the seniors, I can play the whites, or I can play the blue tees. But if my wife goes out to play, she's playing from the red tees, and there's only one option in it. And if you bring your kids out, the shortest option is the red tees. And I feel like there needs to be more options, shorter tee options, for the average golfer. We're trying to get people out to play golf, and I played a golf course the other day from the back tees. It was 6,200 yards, and it was an incredible 6,200 yards. And when I was a kid, I used to play Bethpage Black from whatever it was, 7,400 yards. I don't want to do that anymore. But what about doing that with these more newer, you know, when you're doing a redo of some sort, about putting, you know, shorter tee boxes in to try to attract more players?
Yeah, and, you know, that is critical for the game of golf, because, you know, our problem within the game is oftentimes the game just takes so stinking long to play, and we're playing everything back. And I think that it's a couple things. One is, through all this tree planting and all of this toughening of golf courses, we've made golf course, the experience, longer, harder. The game doesn't need to be harder. It's hard enough to hit the ball on the face. Okay, so what's happened here is that by tree planting, we've narrowed fairways. We've given all golfers less room to play golf, to recover from golf shots. And we're playing this penal game, which creates and takes more time. So there's a couple things. One, I think golf courses need to go wider and create more scale, to create more width, to create more, you know, opportunities to play a different kind of game. So I think, you know, because we're not bowling. You know, bowling, there's a narrow lane. You throw the ball in between the lanes, that's it. But we have a wider game. So I think there's that we need to do, which most golf courses can do that. And then they can also play it forward, which we are now going to other clubs and seeing. I mean, I put in all of our golf courses, we put tees, you know, markers in the fairways at the fairway start, so you can play it right then. So you're not having to, you know, play from the red tees. You can actually play it forward for kids. And you know, the USGA is working on a program with that and have implemented that. But at Philly Cricket, which is an interesting Tilly golf course that was Tilly's home course, they actually rate the women's course from not only the red, but the white and the seniors. And the women can play it in front of the reds, or they can play the reds, or they can play, you know, the seniors, but the course is rated for them. And I see that happening now, too, so that guys, you know, all men and all, and women, have a chance to play three different golf courses. You know, so you can play it shorter, quicker, you can play it longer if you have the time. But I think the game's got to become a little more flexible. And those are two areas that are, you know, there's an opportunity on every course to do that.
You know, it's interesting you said widening the golf course. I see what you did at Sands Point and at Fresh Meadows especially, where you did that. You widened the golf course. And I think a lot of the average golfer says, oh, that makes the golf course easier. And I don't believe it's the case at all. I think it makes it appear more easier and certainly makes it maybe more playable. But, it you know, when you expand the greens and you put the pins more in the corner, it can actually become more difficult, but more enjoyable at the same time.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, we did that at Fresh Meadows. We've done that at Century. You know, we did that at Sands Point. I mean, Sands Point is a shortish golf course and a very small golf course, yet so you would think, oh my gosh, then we need to make everything needs to fit that. But it's actually, Tilly did the opposite. He widened it. He created it really expansive. And it doesn't make the golf course easier. What it does is it makes it more enjoyable. And the game's got to become that. You know, it's got to become quicker, more enjoyable. And, you know, I've never done any work, you know, at Philly Cricket or anything, and dropped trees, made it wider, and had scores go lower.
You mentioned earlier, and I hate to backtrack for a second, but you mentioned when you're talking about Sands Point and what Tilly did at Sands Point, and this idea of, you know, carrying on the spirit of the golf course architect, like, let's say, Tilly. How do you do, for someone like Tilly, who is not, doesn't necessarily have a signature, who basically did things that he just thought was that in accordance with the land that he was using. He didn't have a signature necessarily move or stamp that necessarily that some of the other golf course architects had. So there's no sort of go-to textbook for Tilly, I guess you could say. How do you carry on the spirit with somebody who didn't have a go-to signature bunkering or green style or whatever the case may be?
Yeah, so I think what's interesting is, like, when I work in Tilly golf courses, I study all of his, you know, I've studied all of his golf courses, so I understand generally the framework of what he did. But what Tilly did is he used what was best available, and he used it, you know, in an optimum fashion. But what Tilly did is he executed his work with boldness and courage. And that's something that is really, really critical with Tillinghast. He wasn't afraid. You know, what's interesting is now, if some golf architects, if even I was creating a new golf course and I put it, you know, as Tilly would have done it, I would be chastised because
right. It
would be it would be so bold, so over the top. But Tilly, in the 20s, he wasn't afraid of that stuff. You know, today, we have to watch what we say. Everything has to be politically correct, even in the game.
Right.
But, you know, in the 20s, he wasn't that. So Tilly had a boldness, yet it was softly placed. And I think that's just a wonderful element of, so I'm always mindful of that. Then also, you know, Tilly, even on one golf course, there would be two or three variations of bunker style that he would employ depending on the shot.
Right.
And that's also interesting, which is atypical of everyone else.
We have time for one more question. I wanted to ask you, if you woke up tomorrow and the USGA, and you open up the paper or you would go online and you found out that the USGA rolled the ball back, and what would be the first thing that came to your mind?
No way.
How great would it be if you had heard that news, if that was a reality? How great would that be for the game of golf?
Well, it would be fantastic. I mean, let's face it. All of us play a normal game of golf, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then there's the guys that we all watch, you know, that play a different kind of game because of the what they can do with the ball and the club and the whole combination. And the problem is the game is being driven for that game instead of the game that we all play and enjoy. And, of course, there's so much money in golf beyond, you know, well, in the balls and manufacturing everything else. And the USGA just isn't going to step up. But how wonderful it would be if they did.
And how much money they would, you know, golf courses would save on maintenance, and how much more enjoyable the round of golf would be playing a shorter course that didn't have to be, like Woody was saying, 70-something hundred yards. You could play a 6,200-yard course and feel quite comfortable on it. Keith, I can't thank you enough. We really appreciate your insights and you taking the time to come on this morning. Awesome talking to you.
Well, you guys are great. Thank you so much for allowing me on your program. I just so appreciate you and the opportunity to talk with you.
Thanks. Take care. All right, we're going to take a short break, 30 seconds. You're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsia.
Play like a pro with a custom set of PXG clubs in your bag. Designed to deliver unrivaled performance and fitted to optimize your game, PXG clubs will help you unlock your true potential. We guarantee you've never played like this before. Get fitted for PXG clubs at Pete's Golf Shop today.
All right, welcome back to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. In studio, Woody Lashin, Pete's Golf Shop. Woody, wanted to just get your opinion on the USGA's joint late Friday night news dump with a joint announcement with Scotty McCarron and Bernhard Langer talking about basically both addressed the idea of them anchoring and all this stuff that's been going on and the pictures and the video, basically calling into question the integrity of both Langer and McCarron, and the USGA saying that they have no problem what's going on with those two, given the fact that they're really leaving it up to the player to call their own penalty.
Well, I mean, is it not golf, right?
Yep.
Golf, you're supposed to call your own penalties. I think it's one of the great things about our game. If the ball moves and you saw it move and you caused it to move, you call your own penalty. You know, it's unlike any other sport where there's a referee there and you're trying to do whatever you can to get around the referee. I mean, I think it's one of the great things of our sport. And if they say they're not anchoring, then, you know, unless you have some blatant evidence, which there isn't, then that's the way it should be.
Brandel Chambly had an article about this, and in the article he had this anecdote about Arnold Palmer and him playing with somebody, and he had, I don't recall exactly who it was, but they said, he had said, is that, you know, what do you think of this mark over here? Can he wanted to fix it. And he didn't want to fix it if he didn't think it was a ball mark. And so the guy he was playing with said, "I'll give you the benefit of the doubt, Arnie." And Arnie said, "I don't want the goddamn benefit of the doubt. I want to know what you think." And my point is yeah, we call our own penalties, but if it looks bad, do we still want to be associated with it?
I guess that's the pitfall of calling your own penalties.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, if you're going to allow us to call our own penalties, then you're going to have to live with those rules. There's some people that are going to push and say, oh, that ball mark, well, you know, they knew it wasn't a ball mark, but they asked, and because their opponent said, if you think it is. But that's up to your own integrity.
Right.
And, you know, I like that because I feel that, you know, most golfers have great integrity. And listen, you're never going to make it perfect, but you want a referee out there following everyone around? I do not.
No, I just want them to get rid of the rule.
Yeah, well, I don't like the rule either. By the way,
yeah,
that's not the point.
I think I think it is part of the point in the sense that their only solution is to make it more difficult. You know, to now you're calling it the question. People's, you know, looks bad. They don't want to do it. You know, I don't know. If they got rid of it, it wouldn't be an issue altogether. I don't know. That's just my opinion. It's amazing how fast 30 minutes goes. Woody, always a pleasure to have you in studio. Thank you for coming in, man.
Thanks for having me. I always love it.
That's it, folks. Make sure you go see Woody at Pete's Golf Shop, get fitted, or see your local PGA professional and start getting lessons and get that handicap down. You're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. Have a great weekend.